like guy like me is just automatically trounced by like the pop stars or whatever, because I'm just put in the same arena as them and they're so much louder than me. Like then it's just kind of the wrong place, but that's the only way to go about it. It's not a great business setup.
I mean, we're all expected to be videographers and influencers and all of this at the same time, and I'm not any of those. I'm a songwriter.
I was terribly ambitious, really, both in terms of getting on top of the pops, but also in terms of getting my vision to come true.
For every Coldplay, there's 10 other Coldplays that all got signed in the same year. You know, yeah, there's a lot of broken dreams in the business.
If I had to be what they used to call a cult artist, well, then you'd have a fierce and small group, but you'd still be able to work in music and not in the laundry room at the hotel.
You know, when I started out, I was 17, I was playing the bars doing cover songs. And I just remember every now and then stumbling upon a chord progression or something and being really fascinated by what they do.
You have to make mistakes because that's the sort of edge of your seat drama that being in a band should be.
Making a hit record is tough, but maintaining success is another skill entirely. On The Art of Longevity, we explore the artist's experience of the music business from the inside. I want to find out what separates those artists and bands that have survived decades in the music business from all those who've fallen by the wayside. We follow a narrative inspired by a quote from Brett Anderson of Suede, who said that all successful artists have followed a similar career arc, like stations of the cross. The struggle, success, excess, disintegration, and if you're lucky, enlightenment. With insights and stories for music fans, aspiring musicians, and creators, this is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Dylan Phillips from Half Moon Run, welcome to The Art of Longevity. How are you and whereabouts are you?
I'm great. I'm on a day off in Utrecht right now.
Yeah, you're between dates on the European tour. So where were you yesterday? Where will you be tomorrow?
Yeah, we were in Nijmegen yesterday, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And then, yeah, tomorrow we are playing in Utrecht in a beautiful venue called Tivoli Brandenburg, which we're very much looking forward to. But we just got a few more left on this tour in the Netherlands, and then we're going home.
Do you finish in Berlin?
We finish in Maastricht.
Okay.
We played Berlin a few days ago, I think.
All right. I was trying to get out to Berlin to see you. I just couldn't make it work. And that's why I thought maybe I still had time.
the Berlin show was incredible. There's something about Berlin crowds. They wouldn't even let us leave the stage. They were crazy for it.
Okay. I want to maybe tap into that a little bit because I was at the London show. But first of all, tell me, how have the European shows been going down?
Yeah, really couldn't hope for it to be any better, actually. You know, always a little nervous before going out on big tours, especially after the pandemic, you know, kind of got used to a different lifestyle in a way. A lot of the work we were doing for a long time was being creative and writing music and getting in studio and, you know, little projects here and there. But in terms of the long haul on the road, we haven't done that for a long time. So we were all like, okay, we're going back to this. This is what we want to do. We've done this before. But it still kind of felt new again. And being a trio again was kind of a new dimension to it.
It's a great point because to some extent, all bands are both recovering from the pandemic and not being able to do what you love to do, but also going into a very different environment, right? I mean, making a tour work, right? It's harder than it was before the pandemic.
Definitely. Yeah, it's tricky. You know, looking at the fundamentals of the whole thing, like, you know, tour buses cost twice as much as they did before. Venue rental fees have gone up. I was reading some crazy stats where like half of technicians, like touring crew, have left the business. At least that was true in Canada, which makes them a lot harder to find. You know, and then agents are saying ticket prices have to go down a bit. Economic situation is tough out there. If you want to fill up the venues, then it's tricky. You know, all of those things are kind of working against you. But it really makes it feel that much better when we come to Europe and see that, no, we can still make this work. And, you know, it really feels like a special connection with the crowd as well. Like we're all sharing something here.
Well, look, I got to say this because I go to a few shows. So I, you know, maybe a couple of times a week, and you know when a show is special. So recently I was at the Kentish Town Forum, which in London, which is one of my favorite venues there too. So it's another nice venue, which we'll talk about in a second, because you're on a nice circuit in a way. There was something about the atmosphere there. I remember at the end of the show, the audience just was still standing there. It's like almost like they were waiting for you to come back on after the encore, or they were just stunned. And there was a really special feeling just being down there on the floor. It was there. So how are you feeling that on stage?
I mean, it's a good question. Usually the way that, you know, you feel it is while you're playing, and especially when we're playing new songs, to hear people singing along with new songs, that's always a moment. Because even in previous records, you know, even with songs that have done well before, kind of their first time on the road, even if people are enjoying them, they're kind of like experiencing it somewhat for the first time. We're not to the point of singing along to verses and things like that. But I remember in I think London specifically, noticing how well Alco went over and that people were singing along to that one. And I thought, wow, that's fast. That's fast. I thought, okay, this is probably a good sign.
Yeah, I guess that is a special feeling when the crowd are singing the new songs and, as you say, the verses as well, because then you know, right? Because otherwise, how do you know with new stuff these days if it's landed, unless you got to number one in the charts, and even then?
Yeah, it's a tough one to gauge the crowd interest and if things are going well. And every new album you do, there's always a fear that did we miss on this one or not? You know, even if you love it yourself, you know, you can never expect that everybody else is going to feel the same way. And you know, you always hope that people are going to latch on to the new stuff.
In Kentish Town, of course, you had the string quartet. Was that the only show with a string quartet? Was that something that you could only kind of make happen in London?
Yeah, it was unfortunately the only show, but it was a very special show, and we were really happy to have those girls with us. But we just simply couldn't afford to have a string quartet on the whole tour. But ideally, in the future, we could. A lot of songs use strings, and we're used to working with the same string quartet at home that we've worked with for about a decade now. And I think strings make up a great, it's a great enhancement to what we're doing already as a trio.
Yeah, and of course, for the songs on Salt, which have most of them have string arrangements, it was just, yeah, really, really great to hear. I got to tell you, though, that after that show, I kind of changed my plans around. I saw you were playing in Manchester. I knew I couldn't get to Europe, but I could get on a train to Manchester. So I did that on the following weekend. So you played the Albert Hall, which is another stunning venue. You know, I took a friend along. Actually, ended up taking three friends along to that gig. And about a third of the way through the show, I remembered that you didn't have the string quartet. So, you know, it was a nice embellishment to what you do, but you don't need it there to make that sound, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, we try and write the music in such a way that it really kind of underscores the, you know, the trio that we are, and the way we lean on each other musically and otherwise, and in terms of the arrangements and stuff. And then so we try and write it in that way, so we're not dependent on external musicians for, like, you wouldn't write a lead part necessarily for external musicians, but at the same time, I do sample some string stuff and play it myself in the keyboards. When we don't have a quartet, then all of a sudden I've got more stuff to do in the keyboards than I'm already doing.
Yeah, I guess it was nice to not have to do all the extra stuff. But it was interesting as well in the audiences, because I was trying to gauge, you know, how many people there were really hardcore fans. I think it was maybe the majority, but they'd all brought friends along. So they were all kind of probably just trying to, you know, introduce more fans to you as a band. So the fans know that you're multi-instrumentalists and you swap out and stuff like that, which is very exciting. It's always exciting to see that. But I think it was the people who didn't expect that were, you know, the most surprised and delighted. And also for yourself, you know, you're drumming at the back and you're playing keyboards as well. You don't see that very often. That's at the same time.
Yeah, it was, I'm not even really sure how it all began. I guess like I have grown up playing piano my whole life. So keyboards have been something familiar to me my whole life. And I didn't really start playing drums until this band. But when this band started in 2009, I was doing it kind of just for fun. It was, you know, let's meet once or twice a week and just have a couple of beers and have some fun. And I was still in school for piano at the time. So while playing the drums in this band, there was a, you know, we didn't even have a bass player at the time. And I just reach over and there was, you know, an electric keyboard in the practice space. And I would reach over and hit some low notes sometimes. They'd be like, oh, that's nice. You know, you should do that from time to time. That's cool.
On your biog page right there on Wikipedia, it says, so when you formed the band together with Connor, and then you put this ad on Craigslist for a bassist, and then, you know, Devin applied to the ad and couldn't play the bass, but could play everything else. So to some extent, it's part of the Half Moon Run story, isn't it?
For sure. Yeah. I'm not sure if we had a bassist in those early days, maybe I would have just been pigeonholed into my role as a drummer and never to have touched a keyboard in this group again. But I'm glad that I do.
The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Bowers & Wilkins makes some of the world's finest audio products, from the iconic 800 series loudspeakers, trusted by Abbey Road Studios for over 40 years, to the flagship PX8 wireless headphones. This is music as the artist intended you to hear it. I have to ask, just, you know, talking to musicians all the time and being in the business and knowing that when you see a show like you put on, it's not just that you're multi-instrumental, talented group. It's perspiration too. So how much of those shows is work rehearsal-wise and also sound-wise? How do you just pull that off from a perspective of the sound?
Yeah, I mean, it was huge for this album, for the salt tracks that we added to the show. It was a really big process. And also beyond that, becoming a trio again, but having two albums worth of material that were done as a four piece and kind of rethinking how we could possibly make those work as well. And so to begin with, we kind of made sort of this mega set list of every song we think that we'd like to play, you know, leaving off the ones we're like, oh, maybe that's a song from the past and we don't want to do that one anymore. So kind of limited the list in a way. And then I just started making a list, going through it myself, each song, creating a checklist of all the different problems involved. It's like, there are two drum sets. So that's a problem. How are we going to make this beat work with just one drummer? And so I could try and solve that, but then also look at how many other parts are going on in here. How many can I achieve on my own? Can I play bass and that pad part at the same time? If not, what's the challenge? Can I rearrange the keyboard to make it fit in my hand better? You know, like I do all sorts of tricks with MIDI to make it fit into my hands. Because normally, like if you want to hold tenths or play a triad chord while playing a bass line, like it's a little too much stretch for your fingers. But I can reprogram I call them buttons. They're not just keys on a keyboard. I call myself a professional button pusher sometimes. So I'll take one button on the keyboard and I'll turn it into a pad. And now that's one triad. And if the chord changes, I move it to a different button and that's a new triad. And so all that to say, it's kind of like you solve one little problem at a time. And every time you solve a little problem, you inch towards being able to actually play the thing. And I'll do a lot of that work myself beforehand. And I know Devin Connor also working on their own sounds in their own way. And then after a certain amount of time, we say, okay, let's try it out. Let's have a practice. Let's go for it. And then we'll have a list. Sometimes it's just two or three that we work on in a day and really put in the time to try and see if it works. And often, even though I did some good work, it just doesn't sound right for some reason. And then it's like, why doesn't it sound right? Let's try it again. I'll come back with some new bass sounds next time, or let's adjust this, adjust that. And, for a long time, it felt like some of these were like on the edge of impossible in a way. And it took a long time to inch things to where they need to be. But I'm really happy with how it turned out.
It's really interesting hearing you describe that, because after all of the planning and the problem solving individually, you then have to just practice and rehearse, and it does feel like a lot to pull some of those songs off. I think you mentioned at the London show, maybe it was Alco, there was one song you said you've been trying to get live for a while.
Well, yeah, there were a couple of them. Alco was one of them, has been around for a long time, but we've been trying to get that one on a record as well. You know, it's been around for a long time and just didn't quite hit its stride. It's kind of this delicate balance of kind of, you know, it almost has that traditional folk sound to it, but mixed with the electronic elements, mixed with kind of a strange arrangement, you know, with this kind of these sections that are all uniquely their own that don't necessarily repeat. It was really hard to thread the whole thing together. But then the live aspect too was, it was tough. I'm playing hand claps in my heel. Well, I've got several buttons with my feet that, you know, when my hands are both occupied, my feet have multiple roles to do as well.
But then you get the payoff. The crowd is singing the song back. So
yeah. Well, that's really, it's a nice payoff because, you know, sometimes we might think that the song's working, but, you know, it's possible that it just doesn't communicate.
Yeah, there's some elements of the sound as well that were unusual to me. So just one example would be some of Connor's guitar solos in various songs. But, you know, usually you kind of see the whoever's going to play the solo kind of limber up and, you know, the sound man just cranks it up in the mix a little bit and that's how you get to hear it. But it was different. It was like this, it was more of an ambient sound. And so I'm just wondering, like, do you have a sound team that you take with you? How do you work with each individual venue to get that sound right?
Well, just in terms of sound, I mean, our sound guy, Ben Favreau, has been with us for a decade, and he is he's a master of sound, really, and he can work with any type of sound system. You know, he prefers a really nice PA in a really good room, but he's also a master of damage control, which is the words that he uses. And you know, and sometimes there's often damage control to happen if you're in a big room with lots of echo. It's going to be tough for feedback and for clarity. And there are all these different tricks that he uses and ways to try and get the sound clear and forward.
Well, hats off to Dan. It's always good to give a shout out to the sound man, but it makes sense that he's been working with you for that long. Cause I was just thinking that, okay, this takes work. You know, this just doesn't happen where you show up and do a couple of sound checks and get to this level. Okay, so you're playing some nice venues. So when you get to a new city and you check out the venue and stuff, how do you orientate to that venue? What's your routine, if you like?
Well, in Europe, it's been really nice because on this side of the ocean, often there are beautiful catering and backstage setups at the venues. The same, unfortunately, isn't necessarily true on the other side of the ocean, but We're touring in a bus over here with the crew and also the opening band flight on a bus. And when we arrive in a new city, might have a few hours before they open the door to the venue. And then it's usually a nice time to do your morning walk, go see the city, find a nice coffee, you know, find a park somewhere, just kind of slowly wake up and get the caffeine in you and then get to the venue and, you know, take showers and get ready to start sound check. Kind of a rinse and repeat.
Yeah, okay. So the venue in particular, like any particular setup that you or way that you know you've got to play to get the most from a venue?
Often it's not necessarily a question of the way the venue is as much as the way the crowd is. And sometimes there are very different responses, which is interesting. I think in the past, we maybe were a little afraid of it, especially a crowd that's more quiet. When you get used to people screaming along to everything all the time, and then you get to a city where there might be a lot of people, but they're all very quiet and attentive, the temptation is to think that, is there something wrong with us? Are we doing something wrong here? Is it not coming across? Do they not like us? But I think we've come to learn that there are a lot of cultural differences across different places in Europe. And some places we go back to, people are always very attentive when we go there. Often venues in France are like that. When we play in Belgium, crowds are very quiet, but it's fun. It's fun to play kind of with a different spirit in that sense and like really play with dynamics. When the crowd's that quiet, it means you can get down really quiet with your own dynamics and almost to a pin drop level. So you can really play with the range. So then in contrast to the big moments that get explosive, like you can go even more explosive because there's just so much more of a range going on. But, you know, in the louder venues, when people are screaming along, like that's just, it's a feedback loop of electricity. And, you know, that's, it's a different type of energy.
What are you expecting when you get back across the water? You know, having started the tour, if you like, in Europe, what are you looking forward to most about back to the US and in your home country, Canada?
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun to play. We're playing some legendary venues in Canada, and that's going to be, it's going to be a lot of fun, especially after having all this practice in Europe and feeling really confident, both with ourselves and our ability to put on a good show, you know, making micro set list adjustments here and there, finding out when certain songs work better than others, you know, some interchangeable things, but we have the general shape and flow of the whole show, and we know how to play the songs well. And it's going to be great to show that on some of these stages in Canada for sure. The US is going to be smaller venues, but it'll be fun to go back there too.
Well, let's talk about Salt for a moment. Honestly, it's the best thing I've heard in ages. It really is.
Wow.
I discovered it late. It was sometime in the summer. I was away on a break with my wife and we were just having a lazy afternoon in the hotel. I just thought, and this thing just popped up on Spotify because I knew your first album a bit, but then I'd lost touch in between, which maybe I think, you know, not uncommon for a lot of people with the band. I just knew there was something about it. And then I've played it pretty much nonstop. So just talk me through some of how this piece of work was created, because I've been reading a lot about it and there's a narrative around, you know, some of these songs are 10 years old and you obviously went from 4 to 3 between the last album and Salt. Just talk me through the process of how the album came about from the first hand.
Well, it was quite a process and we didn't really know what it was going to look like in the beginning. You know, during the pandemic, we had those two EPs that came out. The first one, Seasons of Change, had kind of a, you know, collection of shrapnel left over from Blemish and the Great Light. And then when we did Inwards and Onwards, that was kind of our own attempt at producing and doing everything ourselves, which was, we're very proud of that effort. But still, after that, we thought like we could use some help here. So in going into the next writing process to say, okay, we want to do our fourth full-length studio record now. How do we want to do it? We really wanted some help. We had done this little project called the 1969 Collective, which our song Fatal Line happened on that. And that was a project of Connor Seidel, who ended up becoming our producer. But that was our first time meeting Connor Seidel. It was his project. He invited us to write a song for it. And it turned out exceptionally well. Our experience of being in studio with him was as good as it could be. He made us feel super relaxed. His choice in tones and sounds and just philosophy of recording and things like that, it just really lined up. We felt like we could just show up and be musicians and talk about arrangement and fun things and just get in there and record. So after that, we thought, okay, let's call him up and see if he's interested in producing our fourth record. And he was super down. He was like, I'm all in. Let's do this. You know, let's make the best possible thing we can do. Let's go from A to Z, everything we can possibly think of. Let's put all cards on the table. Let's figure this out. And one of the ideas for putting all cards on the table was to literally put all songs we've ever recorded on the table and say, well, is this any good? Is this worth thinking about? We had, of course, our list of all the new stuff we've been working on. And in our minds, we kind of thought like, we might have a couple old things, but let's mainly focus on all this new material we have. And it just kind of turned into this thing where we opened the books on everything we've ever done. And in that process, kind of realized that we'd written a lot of great things in the past that just because we'd failed at doing them before, it doesn't mean we'll fail this time. And maybe that we have some new perspective on it now and they're, you know, they might have a chance of success and you won't know until you try. And so we did demos on so many things. I think we redid demos on about 80 tracks total. And from that list of 80 tracks that we then made a huge spreadsheet, you know, with all our votes, you know, check marks and X's and all that stuff. And notes what potential something has, what needs to be changed. It was a massive list. And we just slowly went through the whole thing and whittled it down to a list of 24 that we fully recorded in studio and went for. And then from that 24, then we again, brought it back down to 11 songs that became the final album. But that process of going through all that old music, it was actually kind of exciting. And in some ways, like, some of this old music felt like a gift from our past selves to our current selves. And we were kind of shocked in some cases, like with Dodge the Rubble. We're like, why did we never put that on a record before? Like, it's a great song. And it was actually one of the first three songs we ever did. At the very first show we ever played at the Barfly in Montreal, what do we have? 21 Gun Salute and Dodge the Rubble and Full Circle, I think. Like, those were the first three songs we ever had.
Wow, okay. So in a way then, this is exciting for fans to know that you got from 24 to 11. So do you have a plan for the others?
We do have a plan. They're not all necessarily imminent ideas. But in some cases, the songs are, you know, similar to previous records where, like, you know, Alco didn't quite make the cut this time. Like, maybe it's something to save for future records when we try it again or something. You know, there's going to be some of that going on, but we certainly have songs and ideas that are out there. Whether or not we use the recordings we did, that's kind of questions for the future, but we are actively thinking about ways to do things with the other stuff from that session.
It's very on trend. You know, you can understand why in this day and age we have to keep putting out music. You know, you can't leave it 2 or 3 years between albums. You know, I know you have done that from time to time, but it seems to be a trend at the moment where you get a record. I'm thinking of The National, for example, recently, and then 6 months later you get another one. I think Metric are your Canadian siblings. your yeah. fellow Canadians, Metric, yeah. are about to do the same thing. And yeah, I think it's a good idea. So yeah, make another album.
yeah. Every time we do a recording, you know, for a new session, we should just make sure we record 80 songs every time, so we have a lot of material to choose from.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please take a moment to rate the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, and do spread the word. Also, you can sign up via the Song Sommelier webpage for our newsletter, artwork, and much more. Back to the conversation. So, as you described that process, which were the songs that came together first for the record, and which fell into place later?
That's a good question. You mean like while we were recording it?
Yeah.
That's funny. I actually can't remember like what we started with or what we finished with. It's like but what I do remember is that when we did get into record, it went surprisingly fast. And that was something that was starkly different to previous recording sessions we've done in the past, where like our kind of expectation is that it takes so long to get the right drum sound or the right this sound or find the right chain or, you know, like getting those sort of pre-mixes together before you actually hit record and start playing the tune. It's like sometimes you might spend a day on getting a drum sound or something. And we always thought that was kind of a torturous way to record. But on this time, it just felt like, and this is testament to Connor Seidel and his ability to engineer and produce at the same time, like he would just put up mics and it would sound great. It was very quick from putting the mics up and hitting record, the very small window of time. And sometimes we'd get two, maybe three songs done in a single day, you know, in terms of getting the beds and the main idea of the song. And then after that, you know, it may take us a while to listen to what we did for a while and just think about it and maybe come back, record it again, maybe make a change. It was kind of nice to have the breathing room rather than doing like 6 weeks, one shot in a big studio that you pay big rental fees every day. Like we would just do 2 or 3 days, a weekend here, a weekend there. We'd exchange, you know, bounces back and forth during the week and maybe do a session in our jam space and then go out to Connor's studio. It was very relaxed and we gave ourselves a lot of time to listen to what we did. But while we were in studio, it just flowed like water. It worked really easily.
Yeah, that comes across, actually. So I think despite the length of the gestation period on some of these songs, it's such a cohesive piece of work. It makes sense that you recorded them fast. Over the four records, and when you've been recording records solo or, you know, your other experience in recording, how do you balance the process versus the outcome? Which is more satisfying for you personally?
I think it's the process for sure. I mean, when the process is that much fun and just feels like it feels meaningful just to show up and try something. Like, I think that is much more important than putting too much emphasis on a result that needs to happen. Like, whatever, if you have to shove a circle through a square or a square through a triangle to make this album come out, like, you know, I hate the process of killing yourself to try and force an outcome. It's a lot more fun to try something, take risks, be unafraid to do things that might sound weird or horrible. Like, just have some fun in studio and bounce ideas around and see what comes of it.
Did you know with Salt, and do you even know, might have mentioned a little bit about this at the beginning, that you've made something special?
This is the first time that all of us in the band unanimously have agreed that we were fully happy with the work we did on a record. Every other record we've done before, even if we ended up liking the work we did, like the feeling of coming out of studio or you know, doing one of those you know, nightmarish listening sessions where you invite a bunch of industry and friends into the room and play the album for the first time, start to finish. Like in the past, we've had some really tough experiences of that, where you have this kind of the first time you're listening to your music through somebody else's ears, and you just get terrified that you've done something horrible. Like, we've definitely had that feeling, or if not all of us, then one person here or there has gone through it. But this record, we unanimously loved the work that we did and we're very proud of it, which to me was a very good sign.
With some records, because the whole process these days as a fan is you have to sift through so much material. Music is like the gift that keeps on giving. And a lot of it is superb as well. And every week there are good releases to listen to, but you just can't listen to it all. And so, you know, my method has become like, hey, just whatever sticks, I'm going to pick this one. I'm going to play this one repeatedly. And then, you know, it reveals those hidden pleasures that great albums do. So my favorite song on this record just keeps changing all the time. I could go through the whole Aside One and say at some point, that's my favorite on the record. And there's a fair few on Side Two as well. So, from your perspective, just playing them live, are there some of the songs from Salt that are just becoming your favorites or particularly good for you just playing on the tour?
Yeah, that's it's a varied question. It depends who in the band you ask, for sure. My personal favorite to play on stage is the title track, Salt. I think it just has this ethereal flow to it and just feels like there is no time, and you just sit in this groove the whole time with this rich harmony in the bass. Feels so good to play. But it's a difficult, Dev has trouble playing that one live though. Not in terms of ability, but he just has trouble with his enjoyment of playing it. So we kind of sometimes bounce around, which one is our favorite, and it changes for us too. I think when we kind of learned how to play 9-beat as a trio, I thought that was pretty exciting.
Oh yeah, it's very exciting live. It's very, very cool. Yeah, it's one of my favorites for sure. The other one I've been talking to with my daughter a lot is Hotel in Memphis, which is the one that stood out for her, which has got a kind of Doobie Brothers bounce to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been pitching you left, right, and center to people since hearing Salt. So that's the one I point to. And it's sort of like it feels a little bit super trampy to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Has that ever been in the conversation?
Well, it's come up maybe, like not specifically about Hotel in Memphis, but it has been, you know, has been in the airwaves from time to time. Oh, but Hotel in Memphis is that one also goes way back, and it's taken so many different shapes and forms. It actually began as a solo piano piece. Way back in the day. That sounded nothing like it does now. Which it's one of those strange examples of you take an idea into a jam space that exists in a certain way, and then you try and add an element to it, or, you know, add a B section and do something else to it. And then slowly over time, you know, you lose your A section, you lose your B, your C, your D, your E, your F, your G. And now all of a sudden, okay, we've got H and I, and it's kind of a new song or something. And it was one of those songs that had gone through so many evolutions.
It's a fun listen. You know, I think it has almost as a twin track with Goodbye California, which is, you know, it lightens up the feel of the album because, you know, the rest of the album is quite melancholic. There's a lot of, you know, emotional stuff on there. Those two just lighten up the tone a little bit, which I really love. So just thinking about this, because when I am pitching you, it's to a lot of people who don't know the band or maybe remember you from Dark Eyes or something and maybe lost touch. I don't know. Most people I'm talking to you about just don't know the band. You have to use other bands to describe bands, which must be annoying when you're a musician. But I'm like, yeah, it's a mix of Radiohead and Supertramp. And one of the things I've, out of the many conversations on the art of longevity, is one of the secrets of longevity, if you like, has been for bands to meld their influences together, but into something that is uniquely you as a band. Can you describe your music? I mean, how would you pitch it?
That's a tough one. It's hard, but I like the way that you described how one of the secrets to longevity might be to meld your influences into kind of something that becomes uniquely its own. I think that in a way that's kind of the story of us three in this band that come from very different places and think about music in very different ways, that have each of our own different sets of influences that have affected us over the courses of our lives. And we come into the jam space to write music together, and we have to meld those things together. And we come with an open mind to say, well, somebody wants to go more down the traditional folk route. Somebody wants to try, like, you know, more electronic dance things, or somebody wants to try, you know, just a pure rock tune, or, you know, and we never speak in terms of those genres, but somebody might come in with a riff or an idea, and we're never saying like, oh, that's kind of outside the scope of what we call this band or our sound. I think we're always open to new musical ideas and have never been closed to genres of any kind, really.
Yeah, it's interesting because listening back through the catalog, there are times when you kind of drift off in a very nice way, I have to say. I'm thinking of Black Diamond, which is from Blemish, which is the album before Salt, and Nerve from the first album, where it's almost like going back to the 70s classic rock sound. And then there are other tracks where you're kind of veering more into almost like an old country style. When you're doing that, is there a conversation about, is this going to fit? And was that the case with Salt? Because I think Salt is very cohesive. There's no drifting off somehow. Every track just seems to fit, you know, one after the other.
Well, in Salt, that was kind of part of the discussion in pacing the songs in this way, and even about the song selection itself, came from that sort of cohesive flow that we wanted to achieve, which wasn't actually that evident. When we looked at that list of 24 songs we recorded in studio, it was not evidently clear how we would find some ordering of these songs that would flow well together. And there are some offshoots out there, you know, that we didn't put on the record right now, but that definitely branch out into other styles that would be kind of, you know, might be considered like a little too far out there for this record. But I hope they see the light of day someday, because they were great ideas.
The Art of Longevity is recorded at Cube West Studios in Acton, and sometimes at the Cube East Studios in London's Canary Wharf. Cube is the world's first members studio for musicians, podcasters, and content creators, and it's a real sanctuary for London's independent, inspired creators. It's a real pleasure to record the show here. Yeah, I hope so. Okay, so look, I have to ask, and this is almost with my industry hat on, like with my marketing hat on, because, you know, often the expression people use is that this is a great record, it deserves an audience. With Salt, it definitely is that case, but it's almost like the other way around. You know, that's why I'm, you know, forcing everybody to listen to it. I'm like, you deserve to listen to this. There's a conversation among your fan base, and it's right there on the internet, about like, okay, Half Moon Run made it out of Canada, but why aren't they bigger? And when you make a record like Salt, is there an element of frustration in you or the band that, you know, this is not in the charts somewhere or talked about or played on the radio or any of that stuff?
I mean, I wouldn't say so. I think actually the response to this record has been quite great. And I think the maybe like, you know, in on our first record, like we got onto BBC One and there were, you know, we got some like major commercial radio ads on some of our songs, which to me and to us at the time was shocking. Remember the first time I heard Full Circle on the radio, I thought, what are these guys doing? Like, why are they playing our song? It doesn't make any sense. But I think nowadays it feels like things are a little more of a slow burner. And I actually like approaching things in that way, musically as well, because otherwise like the pressure has become, and we've had this from our labels in the past. They say like, well, you've got this pop crossover potential and you need that radio banger, you know, just, you know, compromise some of your precious artistic integrity just to get that one banger. And then you can do all the music you want to do after that. You know, that was always the, you know, dangling this gold chain narrative that happened for so long.
That's sort of the common wisdom, but I think you're right. I think it's actually gone beyond that now. And maybe it was never the case, actually. I think it was Donny Osmond that said, the bigger the hit, the bigger the liability.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it becomes an albatross hanging around your neck for the rest of your career. So, I mean, Full Circle's not done badly. I think you've hit 50 million streams. So it's kind of the modern version of a hit. You know, you have a big song, you have a fan, not necessarily a fan. Well, it is a fan favorite and everybody expects it. But yeah, I think it's almost from the fan's perspective. You just want more people to hear it. And also you want to see the band have the success they deserve from it, whatever that means these days. Do you have a success conversation in the band or a definition? And are you happy with where you are commercially?
That's definitely a yes and no answer. I think we're very grateful to be in the position that we are, especially, you know, in a world where it feels like it's very difficult to have success with music or as a musician. I had friends during the pandemic, musicians who just simply had to go do something else because, you know, venues shut down, life became harder. You know, a lot of people changed professions, got out of the business. It's tough. You know, like I'm super grateful that we're making this work for sure. But it is a little tough sometimes when it feels like maybe it's hard to make a tour do anything better than break even, for instance. Even though the tour might feel like it's going super well, you know, you want to elevate the show to the production levels that you think makes the music shine in its best way. But it's hard to afford all the things that you need to put on the show you want to put on. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it definitely does. And, you know, again, part of the prevailing wisdom in the industry, I guess pre-pandemic, it wasn't necessarily true, but it's what people felt was that is how bands make money. Because it's hard to make money off of the records. Yeah, you might sell a few physical copies or whatever, but streaming it doesn't really pay. So you go on tour and that's where you make your money. But that's not necessarily true anymore. And so somehow across the piece, I think you just have to have, maybe, you know, what I'm seeing more of is actually signed up yesterday to My Morning Jacket's community, which is, you know, one big family. And it looks pretty cool. I'm like, okay, these guys know where they're going to go from here. And they're a little bit further along than you are. You know, I think they're 8 or 9 albums in, but that feels like the future of success. It's basically, look, how do we just keep the relationship with our fan base tight and just get them to do a little bit more work for us to spread the word? Which, again, as I sense that's happening from people bringing friends and family to your shows because they want them to hear your music. But then, you know, just doing things to build it from there is more purposeful almost than trying to get in the charts or on the radio. So I'm hoping BMG gets that. And they're also patient with this record because, again, I discovered it just a couple of months ago. It's been out since the spring. So you're right. You know, when you've got a record like Salt, it's worth, for want of a better word, working that record, you know, for 12, 18 months before you move on.
Yeah. And hopefully with some more new material to support it along the way.
Are you looking beyond this tour? We've talked a little bit about maybe doing something with some of those other 13 tracks or whatever might happen. Where do you see the future? Do you talk about the future as a band?
We do. We talk about the future a lot. Yeah, it's tough to see too far ahead. For now, I think we're focused on doing the best we can for this record and for the other ideas we have for new releases coming up, which we're all very excited about. But we really wanted to get this thing out on the road and see how things performed, see how things went. I think one thing that's definitely true now is that you can't take anything for granted. So there's no assuming that the tours are going to go well and that the shows are going to sell. We need to put in the work to go out there and do our best to make the best tour we can and see how things go from there in a way. You know, we have ideas for things to come out. We're talking about, you know, when to start writing again and with the wheels are rolling on those types of things, but we also have other projects in our lives and other interests as well. You know, there might be, I'm going to be getting married next year. There may be kids coming into the picture. There's going to be kind of new dimension to life coming forward. But all of us are, you know, we all love this project and are committed to each other and to the music and to our fans and really hope to see some success with this record.
Well, that's good to hear. And congratulations, by the way. With this record, we talked about you found a new label. So, you know, you have some belief in terms of BMG stepping up and signing you. I mean, as a musician, what do you do with that relationship? Do you trust that it's in their hands? Do you take them to task? How proactive are you and who is proactive out of the three of you?
We're all involved for sure on all aspects of things, though, you know, certain individuals have better strengths than others. So, you know, we kind of play into that as much as we can. But I think what's interesting and nice about this relationship with BMG is that it's not as a standard label deal would be, sort of a thing. Like they're working as our distributor more than a label. It's kind of like we're hiring their services as a distributor to help us get the good word out there and get the music, you know, into people's ears. But they offer more than a standard distributor in a way, kind of offering all these label services on top of being a distributor. But at the end of the day, we are the owners of our music, you know, which is a nice feeling and different from the past. It seems like that's a model that more and more people are adopting.
Absolutely. And it makes perfect sense. I think it makes perfect sense, especially for bands that are making music that is going to last, because it's your music. You know, it's not something you sign over to an organization for it to belong to them. And I think it puts you in a good club as well, because what I love about the strategy over at BMG is I've had a lot of their bands on this podcast. So Suede, Ricky Lee Jones, and they're going for classic bands. So I think from that perspective, maybe they understand that what they have in the potential relationship with Half Moon Run, which is these days you have to build a quiet legend, right? Yeah, you know, no modern band is going to be, you know, as big as Coldplay, but you have to have your own version of that.
Yeah, and BMG have been, they really seem like they get it, and they've been present at everything we've been doing, and it feels like a great connection, to be honest.
Yeah, that's good to hear and good to see. Okay, Dylan, I think we're coming up for time, and I don't want to keep you too long. It's your day off.
All good. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, it's been great to have you on. I wish you all the best with the rest of the tour, for sure, and especially when you get back home to Canada. Again, I wish I could get to more shows. It's just one of these things. I'll wait for whatever happens next time. Hope you come back to the UK and the Europe soon. In the meantime, yeah, best of luck with everything, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Good to meet you.
You too.
Thanks, Dylan. Bye.
Bye-bye.